We have students from Tri-County Schools. Would they please stand? Thank you for coming this morning. You may be seated. And we have students from Middleton High School. Would they stand, please? Thank you for coming, and you may be seated. Our students are here with the Court with Class program, which is sponsored by the State Bar and the Supreme Court of Wisconsin. This is a national award-winning program. And we invite students from around the state to join us for an oral argument. And if they accept the invitation, then the students are provided with material about the case that they're going to hear. And some of the classes invite lawyers and others to discuss the case with the students. The additional facet of this program is that the students meet with a justice of the Supreme Court at lunch hour, and everyone is invited to participate in that discussion of the procedures of the court at about noon after this case concludes. Well, we've met you, and I'd like to now introduce the court to you all. Starting on my far right is Justice David Prosser. Seated next to him is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. The chair next to me is usually occupied by the by Justice Babbitt, and he says he's coming, so he may be late. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. Next to me is Justice John Wilcox. Seated next to him is Justice Patrick Brooks, and Justice Brooks is the justice with whom you'll meet at noon along with students from Fort Atkinson and Barneville High Schools. And the final chair on the far left is where Justice Sykes ordinarily sits, and she will not be participating in this case. As the counsel know, she was a trial counsel, part of this case. Trial judge, thank you, not counsel. So I will now call this case 002599 CR State v. Agnello. And arguing for Mr. Agnello is Jerome Wu. Is it Budding or Buting? Mr. Buting.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Jerome Buting, and I'm here representing Lucian Agnello today. This case, like the one earlier, involves the question of the voluntariness of the defendant's confession. This case is before the court on certification from the Court of Appeals, and it's actually the second time that this case has been before the court. First appearance, this court vacated the conviction and remanded it to the trial court, and I'll have more to say about that in a few moments. But I want to point out that when a second good child hearing was held in this case, substantially more facts were developed than the first time, and some errors were also discovered, and it's now undisputed, for instance, that Mr. Agnello's interrogation took place over a longer period of time than originally thought, starting at 4:30 a.m. instead of 6 a.m. when one of the detectives noted his error in a report and in his prior testimony. It was actually an hour and a half longer than what was previously believed as part of the record in the first case.
Can you speak up a bit, please?
Sure. Cases involving voluntariness are necessarily fact-intensive. And the question that the court must look at is whether a defendant's will was overcome by the pressures brought to bear against his power of resistance under the totality of the circumstance.
Say that again, please.
Whether a defendant's will was overcome by pressures brought to bear against his power of resistance under the totality of the circumstances. There must be some police coercion found, I believe. Connolly is clear on that. But that can take many forms, including subtle psychological tactics or strategies. But Stain, in its brief, prefers to look at each factor in isolation. But the case law is clear that the court must look at the totality of the circumstances. And in that sense, it's often said that the whole is greater than the sum of its individual parts. So that this court must therefore consider the cumulative effect of all the factors and understand how they interplay with each other in this particular case.
Now, so you were you present in the courtroom for the prior oral argument?
Yes.
And you heard a discussion?
Yes.
About whether or not this definition, which you give, I mean, what you're defining as voluntary, isn't it, or involuntary? That the will is overcome by pressures brought to bear under totality of circumstances, and if those pressures did overcome the will, it's involuntary, is that right?
Yes.
Okay. And we heard in discussion, isn't that the whole point of question? Interrogation?
I would agree with Mr. Schmall, actually, that the whole point of interrogation is not necessarily to get someone to incriminate themselves, but instead to get to the truth, and that there are many circumstances where police may believe that they have a suspect, the right suspect, but then when they investigate further, they'll determine that that's not the case. So rather than simply trying to get someone to confess, I agree that it's a more limited, should be more limited, that the police should be more objective in their investigation of the facts.
Could I ask a question about what evidence this court should consider in determining the voluntariness of the confession? Do we consider only the second good child hearing transcript, or both?
Only the second, I believe. I think that's clear because when the court vacated the conviction the first time and remanded it, it found that as I understand it, the process that went on in that hearing was flawed constitutionally by the questioning of that went to the truth or falsity of the confession. So I think that we have to look at just the facts. That's why I point out that there are some different facts that are developed, some erroneous and some more detailed, in the second hearing.
Should we not at all take into account Mr. Agnello's statements unrelated to the truthfulness of his confession? Nothing about his version?
No, not in the first. And I think the trial court, actually that issue came before the trial court, and she concluded that she was not going to consider any of the testimony from that first hearing. The state had asked her to consider a part of Mr. Agnello's answers. He did not testify at the second hearing. He did at the first. And so the state asked her to consider some of his testimony from the first hearing, and she concluded that she would not do that, that it was, for one thing, it'd be unfair to take part of his testimony and not hear all of the testimony. So she concluded that since the hearing was back in front of her from scratch, that the evidence that would be considered by the trial court in making her findings of fact and conclusions would only be that testimony.
Well, if there were inconsistencies between the testimony of an officer in the first hearing and then the second hearing, are we not to consider that?
Not unless those inconsistencies were brought out in the second hearing, and some were. That's why I mentioned one of the officers previously testified that he began his interrogation at 6 a.m. And on further review, when he looked at other reports, he realized that he actually began at 4:30. And he corrected that error in the second hearing. The court, I also point out that really there are few significant facts in dispute. Rather, it's the legal effect of those facts that brings us here today. It's well settled that this court will not upset the trial court's findings of fact unless they're clearly erroneous. But this court need not defer to legal conclusions that a trial court makes. So what we look at are what are the historical facts that the trial court found, including what happened, what are the circumstances in that interrogation room involving Mr. Agnello. Normally, findings of fact include weighing credibility of witnesses and making those kinds of determinations, but we really don't have that here, in the sense that the detectives are the only ones who testified. But I believe that the detective's own testimony establishes coercion. In fact, I think they were quite candid that their intent was, they used terms like, we got together and talked about it, how we were going to give him a good hit, and how they would leave him alone for periods of time to let him stew. So my quarrel is not with the trial court's
findings, but with the counsel. You're not quarreling with, but then you're using words like, we're going to give him a good hit, we're going to let him stew, so is that somehow, was this conspiratorial by the police that they were, how can we get this person to fess up? I mean, what?
I think that came out pretty clearly, that was indeed what they were doing. They talked it over, and they came to the conclusion that Mr. Agnello was withholding something. And
is there something wrong with that? Isn't that a normal assumption?
No, not in and of itself. But when you then compare the totality of what they did in order, or how they acted on those suspicions, that's where I think they went overreaching. One difference between this case and the first case focused very much on the individual personal characteristics of the defendant and his mental condition and that sort. Here, we need to focus more on the police conduct, the police tactics, and the totality of the circumstances and how it fit in with this particular defendant. What we have here are a number of factors that I think demonstrated coercion. The first is the length of the interrogation. And even the trial court found that was the most troubling to her. What she found is that he was placed in custody at 11:20 p.m. at his home. He was then taken to the police station at 2 a.m. And then he was placed at that point in a small interrogation room for the next 13 hours and was only allowed to leave once to go to the bathroom during that time.
The evidence indicate that he had to go more often?
No. The evidence was it's not that he wanted to go and they wouldn't let him go.
Yeah.
But that is, in fact, the only time he was allowed to leave the room.
Well, I guess what I'm driving at is that he was able to let them know if he had to use the bathroom, and apparently he used it one time. So there was nothing indicating that he wanted to use the bathroom.
Right. Yeah. No, I simply point out that again, we almost need to place ourselves in those circumstances visually and picture being in a small 8x10 room, no windows, a couple chairs and a desk for 13 hours. And the trial court also noted that he had denied any wrongdoing for basically for 12 hours, from 11 p.m. until somewhere around 11:40 a.m. when, as she put it, and I think the terminology is interesting, he gets to the point where he breaks sufficiently that he is ready to admit his culpability. That's it. The appendix 188. Now, the trial court noted that this was 9.5 hours after he had gotten to the police station. She ultimately concluded that, nevertheless, she didn't think that that was too long, but it wasn't, in fact, troubling to her. And that conclusion, of course, is something that this court independently will make. So what we have then, he then is left alone after that. After he breaks down, he's left alone and chained to the wall. And we'll talk about that in just 1 second. And then ultimately, they get a signed confession from him at 3:20 p.m. That's 16 hours after his arrest, 14 hours after he was taken to the police station, and basically 11 hours after rounds of interrogation began. The issue of restraints, I think, is most important in this case. And let's not hide behind nice terminology here.
Mr. Beauty, what was he arrested for?
He was arrested, evidently, initially, he was arrested on some outstanding warrants for minor municipal, I think there was maybe a paternity warrant.
So not in regard to this particular case?
No. He was taken into custody for those purposes, and then held and questioned.
When he was questioned, was he told that he was being questioned in regard to the murder?
Yes, that was very clear.
So his arrest was for something else, but his questioning is relating to
murder. There was no questioning about the other minor
offenses. He was given Miranda warnings. Did they relate to the other offenses, or to this offense, or both, or neither? To this offense?
Yes.
If he's told that they're questioning him about this offense, and they give him this Miranda.
Yes.
There's no question that he understood those Miranda warnings.
No.
That's not an issue.
That's not an issue.
Part of the Miranda warnings, as I recall, is you can have a cease questioning any time you want. There's nothing in this record to indicate that he ever asked them to cease questioning, is there?
No, although there is testimony that he was impatient at the delays that they sort of built into this process and were wondering why it took him so long to get back and that he wanted to get this over. I think there's testimony to that effect.
You think that was an indication of breaking his will, or you think it was an indication he wanted them to stop, or that he wanted them to continue? What does it tell us?
Well, I think what it tells us is it's just one other little factor, or fact, that demonstrates that the police were getting to the point where they were overcoming his will to resist. And I think that, in large part, we have to look at the fact that this restraint, really what was going on here is this young man was chained to the wall.
How old is he?
20 years old.
He's been before, he lived before.
He did have prior police conduct from contacts. On the other hand, he didn't complete high school. He just got a GED. He was in foster homes for years. So I don't think there's evidence that he was the most sophisticated of suspects. It was more that he would be more.
Counsel, on the restraint, he was chained for a while. He was handcuffed, right?
Right.
And then there was a chain that extended to the place in the wall.
Right.
Now, was there, are you suggesting there should have been, they picked him up on a warrant, and then they later found there was this murder. What type of restraint are we supposed to just guess? Well, there should have been some other restraint. Should have been an officer there at all times, armed or unarmed, to prevent flight, because he was picked up on a warrant. He wasn't voluntarily coming in.
No, that's correct.
But the difference is it's not that he was just handcuffed at the house and then taken into the squad car like they normally would do. It's once they get him into the police station, into the bowels of the building, through this maze of interrogation rooms, he's put into a little room and then handcuffed for long periods of time while he's left alone. There are bullpens available that where people can be locked.
Were the handcuffs taken off when he was being questioned?
Yes. According to the testimony, he was not handcuffed during the questioning, but when they would leave the room for any significant period of time, they would basically chain him back to the wall by the wrist. His arm could move no more than 5 to 6 inches from the wall, which prevented him from walking around the room.
It's like this. But he's at a desk, right?
He
doesn't have to stand.
He doesn't have to stand. He could sit.
Letting him sit.
Yes.
And he could put his head down like that, right?
Theoretically, yes. But he could not
sit. That's the problem.
Because it conveys, well, it's not simply the restraint alone. We have to look at how it fits and interplays with everything else. It hinders his ability to move around. It hinders his ability to get any meaningful rest. And, most importantly, at the time that he gets this emotional break, or breaks sufficiently as the child...
You say, I hate to interrupt, but I just want to... You were talking about he couldn't get any rest that he did in the record, and I have read part of it, but I have not read. Did he say, I'm tired, I'd like to lay down, I want to stretch out, I need to relax?
No, there is no evidence of that. The
he didn't ask to do that?
I don't believe the detective said that he never asked. I think they said that he did not appear tired, wasn't sleeping, but they admitted that during the last interrogation session in the afternoon, he had to be plied with 5 cups of coffee. And we also...
Something that you should know that.
Well, I think it certainly indicates common sense, is that at that point he'd been awake for 31 hours. And one of the detectives did it, you know, candidly admit that being awake 24 hours is hard on the mind and the body, as we all know.
All right, so you got a 20-year-old who has had police contacts, who has been awake for 31 hours. He's handcuffed to the wall, but not all the time, only when there are no police. And they say that they handcuffed him because they're worried about suicide, right?
Right.
Okay. They don't say they're worried about him hurting them, because after all, he's in there now under suspicion of murder. So they're not worried about their danger.
No.
They're worried about him committing suicide.
That's the reason offered. Although, actually, what the trial court found and what the detective said is that is the policy the Milwaukee Police Department has to prevent possibility of suicide for other defendants, but not necessarily this defendant. There's nothing that would indicate that this defendant was in any way
suicidal. I'll assume the Milwaukee police, if they leave him alone in an interrogation room, they chain him up.
Right.
Okay. So we've got 31 hours, 20 years old, chained up. Several officers question him. They're not armed, right? No threats of arms.
Right.
No threat of violence. No indication of any violence.
No.
All right. 5 cups of coffee to keep him awake. What else about this interrogation is there that would make it voluntary or involuntary? What are the factors?
There's the two factors that Steve versus Clappis found as referred to as inherently coercive, and that is lengthy interrogation and interrogation by relays of detectives. He was questioned by no less than 6 experienced, well-trained detectives who would come in teams, one after the other, and made it clear to him that whenever he was denying, that they weren't accepting it. And so all of those factors, I think, combine. I see I'm running out of time here, but all of those factors combine to create a coercive environment. Yeah. I'm sorry.
Trial court found against you, the Court of Appeals.
Did not rule.
Even if you should win on that, what do you win? Win a new trial?
Yes.
Win why? You've never asked for a withdrawal of a plea of guilty.
Well, because there wasn't a need to do that when the case was last before the court, the conviction was vacated at some point in the trial court, so there was no judgment of conviction no need to have done that, no purpose at least in doing that. Instead, it was a hearing on the voluntariness, and I think that was the understanding of the parties. And
talking about the first child or the second child?
The second child.
Can we go back to the first just a second, and then follow up with Justice Abrams? As I understand it, correct me if I'm wrong, there's the good child, the finding that this was voluntary, and then he pled guilty, and then it came up, and in among other things, we vacated the conviction.
Right. And I think
it goes back to good child. Suppose that you win on good child, you lost, and you lost on good child, then you're really gone, right?
Right.
You don't want a new trial. You don't want to withdraw the plea.
Well, I'm sorry. I shouldn't say that. There is a different landscape here. It, certainly, if we win on good child, then he's got a trial, and a trial without a confession has been suppressed. I think it's no different than 971-31 sub 10 appeals, where you can enter a guilty plea, yet preserve your right to challenge a motion to suppress. And I don't think that in each instance, if evidence is suppressed, you then have to go back before the trial court and file a motion to withdraw your plea. I think that's implicit in the whole process. And I think what this court did when it vacated the conviction previously did so because from the point that those improper questions were asked, the process was tainted, due process was violated, and the process was tainted thereafter, and so the appropriate thing to do was to vacate the conviction, put the parties back in the position that they were before the good child hearing, before the plea.
After the conviction, excuse me.
Even if you lose here, you want a new trial.
Even if we lose on the voluntariness of the police confession, I believe he's entitled to a trial, yes.
Hasn't the conviction been reinstated by the trial court?
It was, and I don't think there's any authority for the court to do that.
Well, do you think that maybe that resulted from the way she read the first Agnello decision by this court?
She actually struggled with that. And, I mean, I understand why she ruled the way she did. She made it pretty clear. And she was candid in saying that I don't know whether this is really what it should be doing, and I do it with due deference to the Supreme Court if I'm wrong. But I submit that she was wrong, that she could not at that point simply reinstate the conviction that had been vacated. Due process has to take its course from that point forward, and I think that involves either a trial or a new guilty plea in order to get to the point of a conviction.
Well, given the fact that she did that, wouldn't it seem to make sense to have brought a motion in the trial court asking to withdraw the guilty plea?
I don't believe that there would have been a need or a purpose for that because what Mr. Agnello had was a right to file an appeal decision that this confession would not be suppressed, the voluntariness issue. And so I don't think there was any need at that point or real purpose in filing a motion to withdraw the plea.
How many Miranda warnings were there, if there was more than one? When?
I believe the police said that there were three given. There was actually four separate periods of interrogation, each of which lasted about an hour and a half. 4:30 to 6,
different detective took over 6 to 7:30. Then there was about a 3-hour break, and then another team of detectives took over, and Miranda warnings were read. And then there's another hour and a half. Then there's this emotional break, and then they leave him alone, sobbing, shaking uncontrollably. It was the testimony. And they chain him back to the wall for another hour and a half. And then they come back. And in this last session is when they obtain the confession. And I think by then it's obvious that they're... I see my time is up, but if I can just finish this. By then it's obvious that his will to resist has been overcome by a combination of all of these factors.
Well, the Miranda warnings, could you identify the time when the three Miranda warnings, if there were three?
They testified, I believe, that they were at the beginnings of these interrogation periods. And, of course, those are one factor that work against me, but I don't think they're outweighed by the others. So there would have been one approximately 4:30, approximately 6, and approximately 10, something like that.
No more random warnings anywhere around 11:20 or any time before 4:30?
No, I don't believe there were any random warnings read at that point until he was put from the point of his arrest, you mean at 11:20 p.m. I don't believe there's any Miranda warnings read to him until the interrogation started about 4:30.
Thank you, Mr. Pending. Mr. Weber.
Good morning, Chief Justice, members of the court. The state asks this court for two specific holdings today. First, that Agnello's statement was constitutionally voluntary. And second, that Mr. Agnello was not automatically entitled to a new trial after remand in the first Agnello case. Fairly read, the argument that he's presented to the appellate court on that second point is a request for plea withdrawal, and as such, it belongs in the circuit court, not this court.
What are the grounds for plea withdrawal?
I am assuming that he would argue that he pleaded the first time under the mistaken belief that the equivocal statements he made in response to the prosecutor's questioning about the truthfulness of his confession, that he pleaded guilty believing those could be used as impeachment evidence against him if he'd gone to trial.
And what did the first Agnello case hold?
It held that under Rogers versus Richmond and I think Jackson versus Deno, that questions at a good child hearing pertaining to the truthfulness of the statement rather than the voluntariness of the statement were irrelevant, not relevant to the voluntariness determination.
And asking those questions was prejudicial error.
It was under the facts of this case.
Prejudicial error. Therefore, the conviction was vacated.
The judgment of conviction was vacated and the cause was remanded for a new good child hearing.
He was starting again.
Which was what we all thought, what I thought certainly, what the trial court thought, that the case was going back to status quo ante, that he was being returned to the trial court for a new good child hearing. Presumably, if he'd won at the good child hearing in front of Judge LaMalis, he would have had a basis to withdraw his plea by arguing that I pleaded believing that my confession could be used against me. It can't. Judge, I would like to withdraw my plea and go forward with a trial, and presumably that request would have been automatically granted under this same theory that under 971-3110, if you win on appeal, you go back and you have a good child here.
But no. The second one is what intrigues me, that he pled guilty after the first good child hearing because he thought that certain
of the questions and answers given during the good child hearing would be used against him. And now, what the status quo ante after the appeal is, these babies aren't part of the transcript anymore. So
there,
but I think I heard you correctly, but correct me if I'm wrong, that you said that's a matter for the circuit court to decide and not this court.
Absolutely. There is not a scintilla of evidence in this record to suggest that the reason that Mr. Agnello pleaded out was because he was afraid that the prosecutor was going to use these ambivalent responses to the questions at the first good child hearing on voluntariness against him as impeachment at trial. There's just nothing in the evidence to suggest that. Not in the transcript of the second good child hearing. If you go to the plea hearing,
you're arguing the merits. Are we? I thought you said that we shouldn't even decide the merits.
Oh, yeah,
send it back to the circuit court.
Send it back to the circuit court. Let him make his case there. Let's put on witnesses and let him explain the comment that he made at the plea hearing when he said, "I'm pleading out because I don't want Douglas Stream to take all the weight for it." I mean, if you decide it on the merits, we win. Because the only affirmative evidence in the record suggesting why this guy pleaded out had nothing to do with the first good child hearing. It just seems to the state that this case is in the procedural posture where the argument that was made in this court on brief by the defense really belongs in the circuit court. And there's case authority that the state cites in its brief that says appellate courts can't entertain motions, original motions for plea withdrawal. There were two factual issues that were raised by Justice Prosser during the argument that I wanted to address briefly before I go to merits. Judge Lamalis, the circuit judge at the second good child hearing, expressly considered only the evidence that was generated at that second good child hearing in making her voluntariness determination. That's found at record 54, pages 19 to 20. The record also indicates in the findings of fact that there were three issuances of Miranda warnings, and that's found at record 54, pages 11 and 12. The circuit court's findings of fact are there. I am prepared at the court's convenience to either talk about that second issue or move to voluntariness.
Let me talk about the second issue first, if that's all right.
So could I ask before you do that, why is this court not permitted to consider the testimony of the officers at both hearings?
Mostly because this court, unless the circuit court's findings of fact are clearly erroneous, aren't allowed to go beyond the findings as made by the circuit court. The findings made by the circuit court were based on the evidence generated at that second good child hearing. Judge Lamalis made her own credibility determinations, had her own opportunity to observe witness demeanor. I think it would be inappropriate for this court to go behind those findings unless there was something in that second good child hearing that suggested that she was clearly erroneous in what she found as a matter of historical fact.
Perhaps this is rhetorical, but why is it inappropriate for us to go behind the findings in this case and not inappropriate to go behind the findings in the other case that you said? In other words, you're saying the trial court made findings here and they should be sustained. Don't go behind them. In the other case, trial court made findings, but they shouldn't be sustained in terms of the...
I understood the state's position in the first argument to be that the findings themselves were based primarily on the testimony of two discrete witnesses, mental health witnesses. I'm not all that familiar with the facts of the case beyond what I heard here. But I understood Mr. Freimuth to be arguing that the state or the circuit court placed inappropriate emphasis on some of the witnesses and then erred in the legal
determination as to whether or not that rose to the level of involuntariness. That legal determination, I don't think anybody disagrees, is within your province to review de novo.
Thank you.
I understood the court wanted to go to the second issue. I would prefer to answer questions always.
Well, the court said vacate. Vacate means vacate. It's no longer there. Didn't reverse it. Could have reversed and sent it back. And then the trial court could have said, okay, we think it's voluntary and therefore reinstate the conviction. It said vacate. There was a prejudicial error made in this proceeding, even though it was a guilty plea, and you begin again. And it's my understanding the prosecutor, even after LaMalis' ruling, assumed there'd be another trial.
Well,
is that right?
Right. Two responses to that. First, I'm not sure what was going through the prosecutor's mind when he made that comment. I don't know if it was his belief that the case was to be remanded for a new trial regardless of the outcome of the Miranda Goodchild hearing, the second one. But more to the point, if this court intended that the case go forward, then why specifically remand it for the purposes of a new Goodchild hearing? He found the statements to be involuntary, could have simply remanded it, said go forward. Why bother specifying that it's going back for a new Goodchild hearing if there wasn't some significance as to the original judgment of conviction based on the outcome of that second Goodchild hearing?
I'm sorry, did you say that in Agnello this court found that that was involuntary?
Improper. I'm sorry.
Didn't find it was involuntary. That
no.
was the whole point.
No, I'm sorry.
So
I'm
we're starting sorry. Again.
I misunderstood.
We start again at Goodchild in this case.
Assuming the state wanted to use the confessions, which I would assume was the case. My point is that if it was this court's intent to remand for a new trial or a reentry of plea or whatever was going to play out at the circuit court level, then there really was no reason to specify that it was going back for the purposes of holding a new Goodchild hearing. If the court was convinced that a new trial was warranted under any circumstances or under all of the circumstances, it could have just remanded or reversed and remanded. I can't divine unspoken intent. And it seemed clear to me and certainly clear to the circuit court that the purpose of this was a remand for a Miranda Goodchild hearing, a second Miranda Goodchild hearing, a second Goodchild hearing.
What do you mean by those words then, counsel? I mean, if we got to eat those words, tell us, and I got to write the opinion, what do I say?
Stylistic choice on the part of the authoring justice. I don't know. I'd give a lot to be able to sit in on your decisions conferences and participate in the drafting of opinions.
Well, the request was for reversal. We didn't do that. That was in the brief, right?
There was a request for reversal. There was also another, the second issue did not go up in Agnello. It was only the voluntariness. Ask your question again, please. I'm sorry.
Well, the request was for reversal. So the court obviously used a word that was different than reversal. Suppose they had used reversal, what would your position be here today?
If the court had used the word reversal and remanded for the purposes of holding a second Miranda Goodchild hearing, I would probably be making the same argument that I'm making now, that the reason that this case went back from this court was for purposes of doing correctly what was done incorrectly before. If the circuit court had found the statements to be involuntary, then he would have been entitled to withdraw his plea, or they would have gone forward at that point and entered into new plea negotiations, or they would have gone into trial posture. Part of my problem with the analysis that Mr. Agnello offers to this court is that it wasn't present in the argument that was made in Agnello 1. It could have been made as an alternative argument. If this court concludes that the questioning of Mr. Agnello on the truthfulness of his statement was improper, then we have an interesting situation, Supreme Court, because he pleaded out, supposedly, pleaded out believing that these ambiguous statements could be used against him at the time of the trial. That argument wasn't made to this court the first go-around. I don't know that that constitutes a waiver, but it suggests to me certainly that what everybody was playing for in Agnello 1 was a rule, or what the defense was seeking in Agnello 1 was a ruling that the first Goodchild hearing was bad and that he was entitled to a new one.
What was the state's position in Agnello 1?
All sorts of things. We argued waiver initially. We argued that there's a line of case law, a line of authority, that says that if a circuit judge obtains inappropriate information on the truthfulness of a statement in the context of a Miranda Goodchild hearing, that if the finding of voluntariness is made excluding that information, that the finding is...
You agreed there was error. You agreed there was error.
No, I made an alternative argument. I never agree there's error. I made the alternative argument.
Very reassuring. Okay. So, did you argue that if you lost, then it should only be on the Goodchild, and that the plea should stand, and the conviction should stand?
I didn't include that specific language in my prayer for relief. No, we took the position that the circuit court's handling of the Miranda Goodchild issue was appropriate, or that the defense had waived the argument by failing to make a sufficiently specific objection.
You didn't take the next step. If we lose, then the guilty plea stands anyway.
No. No.
Well, I note in the opinion, the initial opinion, the words reversed and remanded appear at least three times. And those words vacate Agnello's conviction appears really only once. Do you attach any significance to that? It's in our mandate line, nothing about vacating the conviction. And our mandate line is the decision of the Court of Appeals is reversed and the cause is remanded. And the same thing at the start of the opinion. Our forms look a little bit differently than it appears in the book, but nevertheless, it's reversed and remanded. Is there any significance to that we could use?
And again, you're asking the parties to divine intent from the language choices.
Do you think it's just a question of our intent?
As opposed to your authority to?
No, I mean, are we bound by these words, or can we say we didn't intend this, or...
No,
is like dicta, the words vacate Agnello's conviction because of what appears in the mandate line?
I believe this court has authority to clarify its intent as to a particular case or the meaning of particular language. Certainly the parties have come before you today, if not in the form of a formal motion for clarification or reconsideration, certainly a request that this court clarify its position. If that was what the court meant, if the court meant that Mr. Agnello was to receive a new trial regardless of the outcome at the second Miranda Goodchild hearing, then the state loses.
But not a new trial. He'd never had a
trial. Oh, I'm sorry, a trial. That he would be entitled either to renegotiate a plea or to go to trial. If that was what this court intended, then the state loses.
Uh-huh.
I mean, there is no alternative to that conclusion that I can think of. If that was what this court intended, I don't believe it was.
Do you think it's appropriate for this court to state what its intent was? I mean, this was, what, 3 years ago? I can't remember yesterday.
And we have talked about that among ourselves at the Department of Justice. The faces have changed on the court. We have people who were not on, and people who were on are no longer on. I think the court can speak with an institutional voice. You can see in certain decisions of the Supreme Court where the court will say we were mistaken or we were unclear or we failed to consider X, Y, or Z 10, 15, 20 years down the line when the personnel have changed. I think this court always has the authority to speak with an institutional voice on its earlier pronouncements.
Mr. Weber, what is it that wipes out that guilty plea? We never said the guilty plea was withdrawn. No other court has said that. The defendant has never brought a motion to withdraw that guilty plea. So when I look at this, I'm having difficulty understanding why that guilty plea isn't still there as a valid guilty plea at this point.
The position that the defense has taken in the litigation is that when this court vacated the judgment of conviction, the guilty plea became a nullity. I think my position would be, if you put that aside for a second, when Mr. Agnello goes back to the circuit court, gets his second Miranda Goodchild hearing, and let's say that Judge LaMalus had suppressed, I would think the next procedural step would be for the defense to ask for permission to withdraw its guilty plea based on an argument that you pleaded guilty because those admissions would be used against you at trial. Now that they can't use the admissions, I prefer a trial. I think that would be the procedural posture, and that's why I have great difficulty with the defense coming into this court saying, oh, the historical landscape or the legal landscape of this case has changed so much. That's an argument that needs to be made in support of a motion for plea withdrawal. It's not an argument that should be made to this court saying that the consequences of its earlier decision have somehow led us to this intolerable state of affairs. It's an argument you make to the circuit court.
So the state really is taking the position, as I understand it, that guilty plea is still there. Nothing has occurred that would wipe out that guilty plea.
Nothing has occurred that would wipe out that guilty plea, and on this record, there is nothing to suggest that the reason Agnello pleaded out the first time was because he was afraid of being impeached by those ambivalent statements that he made at the first Miranda Goodchild hearing. Only affirmative evidence we have in the record is his sworn statement at the plea hearing indicating that he was pleading guilty because, as we argue in the brief, that it was driven by a desire for acceptance of responsibility for the crime. They didn't want Douglas Stream to take the weight for it.
What is the test for voluntariness that we ought to be applying in this case?
We cite it at page 4 of the state's brief, and it's nothing more or less than Clappus. The test for voluntariness is whether a confession was procured via coercive means or whether it was the product of improper pressures exercised by the police. The presence or absence of actual coercion or improper police practices is the focus of the inquiry because it is determinative on the issue of whether the inculpatory statement was the product of a free and unconstrained will reflecting deliberateness of choice.
So would you, in essence, you were in court for the argument, the last case, would you agree with the state's statement of the test for voluntariness?
As I understood the original argument, and please remember, I haven't reviewed.
Voluntariness is a totality of circumstances weighing police conduct versus the characteristics of the suspect.
I think you only do that weighing if you have evidence of improper coercion or improper police conduct in the record. That's what I understand the Connolly and Clappus tests to be. Now,
but you don't think it's a totality of circumstances test?
It is a totality of circumstances test, but you are only, I mean, you're examining everything the law enforcement officers did in the context of questioning.
And in the context of the specific defendant.
And in the context of the specific defendant. If you find evidence of improper police conduct or coercion, then you balance the personal characteristics of the defendant against the coercion to make a determination.
But it's a sliding scale.
I mean, it might be a pea under seven mattresses for one defendant, and it might be a boulder that's not felt under a sheet.
I understand that, and I'm at somewhat of a disadvantage here because, frankly, in the moments before this oral argument, I was thinking about my case and not Jim's. We do not have a factual set of circumstances in this case that's on all fours with Mr. Frymuth's case.
No, but we have a test that we have, that obviously these cases were put on the same day because we're, you know, looking at that test.
I understood Mr. Frymuth's position, too, to reflect the very unique circumstances that he had in that case, a defendant who was arguably in a compromised medical situation at the time that the questioning was taking place. I'd much prefer that you base your analysis on what the parties believe the test should be in that first case on their briefs. I'm sorry, I don't mean to dodge, but...
So we have to find improper conduct, improper coercion.
I believe so.
Okay, so 31 hours awake without sleep?
Well, that's a little misleading.
Okay.
The
How many hours do you think it was that he was awake without sleep?
The hours that he was awake without sleep, I have no quarrel with the circuit court's findings of fact. What I think it's important to remember is we're talking about a situation where he was in police custody at the police administration building for 13 hours. You'll find that finding of fact at record 54, page 5, and page 13. The actual questioning took place over a period of 11 hours. There were multiple breaks taken, 1 3-hour in length, with time given to Mr. Agnello away from the questioners. You'll find those findings of fact at record 54, page 5, pages 6 and 7, pages 12 and 13, and page 16. You will also find in the findings of fact that Mr. Agnello had unimpeded access to all creature comforts, food, water, toilet access. You'll find those findings at record 54, pages 13, 14, and page 18. You will also, if you review the record, find nothing in the record to suggest that Agnello ever said he was tired. He never asked to stop the questioning so that he could sleep. You'll find those findings at record 54, page 17. You'll find the circuit court's finding of fact that Agnello was capable of sleeping in the questioning room when he was left alone, if he had chosen to do that. You'll find that finding of fact at record 54, page 10, and page 17.
Does the handcuffing to the wall bother you? Standard practice for everyone?
It bothers me considerably less than a successful suicide attempt on the part of someone who's being held in custody. The circuit court made an uncontroverted finding of fact that the restraint was not for purposes of coercion, but was for the protection of the inmate in custody.
Even though it was a standard practice, regardless of what the inmate was there for.
The record says that it was a standard practice of the Milwaukee Police Department. I have no basis to go behind the record on it. But I think two important points. First of all, there's no reason to believe that this restraint was for any purpose other than to better ensure that the suspect didn't commit suicide or attempt to commit suicide while in custody. Secondly, and we argue this on brief, there really is no affirmative evidence of causality here. When the man is telling you, or when the witnesses are telling you that the man never asked to sleep, never said he was tired, when the court makes a finding that he was capable of sleeping had he wanted to do so, when there's no affirmative evidence in the record to suggest that this was a cause of this guy's making his statement, there really is no basis for this court to disagree with the circuit court's findings of fact or the conclusion of law that draws from it.
In the state's brief, we also cite a number of...
No, you've gone too far. There's certainly a basis for disagreeing on the conclusions of law.
Not in light of the more persuasive legal authority that's out there, which we cite in our brief, cases where the improper length of custody and interrogation is measured not in hours but in days. There's also persuasive case authority that stands for the proposition that when you have a lengthy period of interrogation and you supplement it with breaks, with access to creature comforts, with food, with water, with tobacco, when there's nothing in the record to suggest that the man made any requests that weren't honored, the length of interrogation in this case is not constitutionally significant.
Is this a correct statement? This court must credit the circuit court's finding that with the breaks taken during questioning, the time lapse was not so long as to improperly overbear Agnello's will. What I'm driving at, it seems to me, the circuit court made a finding as to time. You've got unless it's clearly erroneous, and I don't see that it is, we have to accept that. But the whether or not it was long enough or so long as to improperly overbear Agnello's will, that's a conclusion of law, and we don't have to accept it.
Absolutely correct. And counsel for the defense pointed that out, and I freely admit that that is not a finding of fact.
Just so we all agree on the standard of review.
Yes, no. State agrees on that point.
Counsel, if the standard practice for purposes of making sure someone in custody doesn't commit suicide, regardless of whether there's any indication of suicidal ideation, if the standard practice was to have them cuffed both hands, does that change your argument?
It could. It could. If the standard practice of the Milwaukee Police Department was to restrain every inmate with a 4-point restraint, and then to put an iron bar behind them, pushing into them so that there was no possibility of them moving to commit suicide, yes, that would be an institutional action that would support a finding of coercion.
So it seems to me that the response, well, it's a standard practice to prevent suicide, sounds good, but really what we have to look at is the activity here. I mean, just like it's 4-point restraint. Oh, they're doing it for your protection. You know, sounds good, but we have to look at the activity and how that interplayed and balanced against the particular characteristics of the defendant, regardless of what their policy is. Is that correct?
I think that's fair, and we're certainly prepared on the facts of this case to have this court gauge the constitutional significance of the restraint at issue, given the findings of fact that the circuit court made.
I'm sorry, and if Justice Bradley asked this, I did not hear that part. Did they take away his shoelaces and belt?
I don't know. I don't know if they did or not.
I mean, those are usual, as I understand it from the movies, usual things that are done on suicide watches.
I think in some circumstances, law enforcement officers will routinely take away anything that could be used as a ligature. I don't know if that happened here, and it's not in the record.
And perhaps it may not have been necessary because of the chain being having the handcuff, which would make it difficult to do anything else.
Possible. I thank the court for its consideration.
Did the court find any coercive tactics?
Improperly coercive tactics? No, none. I think that's part of the point that we tried to make on brief by citing this court to Oregon versus Mathiasen. There is a certain amount of emotional tension that is inherent in any questioning situation. We also cite this court to United States versus Rutledge in the brief. It's a Seventh Circuit case that talks about The role of the police in interrogation is not to be a fiduciary for the suspect. That's not law enforcement's institutional role in an interrogation situation. Thank the court.
Thank you, Assistant Attorney General Weber. Mr. Buting.
With regard to the restraints, I think the court is getting at is that you look, it's really not the subjective intent of the officers. You have to look at the effect, objective effect on people. If we use the example of the four-point restraint or the straitjacket, if someone's put in a straitjacket because the police have a policy that we're going to prevent suicides, is anyone really going to argue that that didn't have a coercive effect on the suspect? No, it clearly does. And I think you look at the handcuffs the same way. Plus, there are other factors. I mean, if suicide was really the concern here, I mean, certainly jails and mental health facilities have higher suicide risks than this. And they don't chain people to the wall. They use observation, not isolation. What we have here is the police made a choice. They preferred isolation because that was part and parcel of their psychological course of tactics. And there was a bullpen right around the corner. The one time he was allowed to use the room, he went to the bullpen where there was a facility. So it's not like there wasn't other options if they really thought that suicide was a risk. And if police want to use this tactic, they take the risk that it's going to be found to be coercive. And I think that message has to go out to them that there are other better ways to deal with the concerns that they, legitimate concerns that they may have about suicide. And if they choose to take use a tactic that is coercive, they assume the risk that any statements derived from that will be found to be involuntary. If I can go back for a moment to the question of a new trial and what happened in the first case, the prayer for relief actually was to reverse the conviction and also to make a finding that it was involuntary. Now, what the court did was vacate the conviction, and I think vacate means vacate. There's sort of a public policy issue involved here, too. I think litigants have a right to rely on plain meaning of the court's decision. And if we're to say that vacate doesn't mean vacate somehow, it's all that's going to do is encourage more litigation as parties come back a second, third time, whatever, to try and modify what this court has already said.
Frankly, what difference would it have made if it reversed or vacated? It was gone.
That's right. That's right. And what it does is, there's no authority that says when this court vacates a plea or vacates a conviction that you then have to go back to the trial court and file a motion to withdraw after a good child hearing or some other kind of suppression hearing. There's just no authority for that. I mean, the whole process of 97131 is to allow more efficient use of judicial resources, and that when this court rules that a conviction is vacated, you're back to square one at that point.
When did he plead? In my limited experience of criminal law before I came on the bench, I found that the statutes provided one time for pleading, but the Dane County Circuit Court practice took a plea earlier and then took it again later. When did he plead here? Before or after the good child?
After.
First one.
After the first good child hearing. It was not until after the court had ruled against him on the good child hearing and had ordered him to answer the improper questions.
And that's when you take the plea.
Right.
So Well, if you sent it back for a new good child, then if you just followed ordinary procedure after the good child, you'd ask him for his plea.
Right. And under these circumstances, when this court vacated it and sent it back, what I believe should have happened is that the due process of law would require that it proceed either to a trial or a new plea in order to get a conviction.
Well, you wouldn't take a new trial until he pled. He'd have to plead not guilty to get a trial. So after the good child, they should have asked him how he pleaded.
They could have done another arraignment, yes. They didn't. The court didn't even go that far. The court just sort of took it out of the party's hands. The parties did believe. The prosecutor asked to set a trial date. And the parties understood that that's where the case was going. And in the court's sua sponte, they said, well, now, wait a minute here.
Well, what I'm trying to say is if the conviction was gone and we were starting at the good child, then the step after good child is a plea. Is that right?
Yes, then it would be not guilty or guilty, and then if it's not guilty, set it for trial.
Thank you, Mr. Buting, and thank you, Mr. Weber, for your argument in 00-2599 CR State v. Agnello. That concludes our argument in the case. The students will remain. Other students will join them, and you will meeting with Justice Crooks, who's going to come back, even though he's not listening to me now. And we will be in recess until...